Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Since necessity is the mother of invention, a new forecast about the future of Boston could be what the city needs to rethink and renovate our transportation system. The problem is we have under 15 years to do it. Yesterday, the business group A Better City released a report showing the increasing strain that a growing population will place on our roads and rails by 2030. Here with us in Studio 3 to elaborate are Rick Domino and Barry Bluestone. Rick is chief executive of A Better City. Barry has co-authored the report, and he's a professor at Northeastern and the founding director of the Kitty and Michael Dukakis Center for Urban and Regional Policy. Rick and Barry, it's great to see you both.
Thank you.
Hello.
Okay, I read this thing last night and was totally and thoroughly depressed because I always complain to Jim that even now there's no good time to get out of Boston, whether you go at 11 o'clock on a Saturday morning, you go at 3 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon. The only time to get out of Boston that you're not going to be sitting in traffic on the Southeast Expressway is midnight or like 2 o'clock in the morning. So now I learn that it's not going to be just the expressway. It's going to be Logan. It's going to be the Red Line. It's going to be a total disaster. So give us sort of the brief summary of what a disaster we're looking at coming down the pike here.
Well, we asked Northeastern to take a look at some very important characteristics about the future. And I'll let Barry speak to the fact that they did a wonderful job at looking at labor forecasts, demographics, population growth. They also look at economic output. But when they did all those numbers and calculations, one of the numbers that Barry's spoken to and I speak to now is that there's, you know, one of the vehicle estimates is that could be as many as 80,000 more vehicles on our regional
That's
highway
good.
System, right? Now, again, it's
80,000 per what, Rick?
It's a daily,
okay,
yeah. And that's a lot of vehicles. And again, it's all related to very good science and research that Barry and his team did. But obviously, as Marjorie, you're saying, where are those cars going to go? Barry, and I'm going to turn it over to you, because Barry did this great calculation about how long that many vehicles could mean. So, Barry, explain to Marjorie what that could look like.
So, Marjorie, you're on 3 coming north.
Yes.
You're now averaging 10.3 miles per hour. That's the official how fast.
This is in the morning.
AM commute.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
So people are listening, and they're able to close their eyes and drive at 10.3 miles per hour. Once we have 80,000 more vehicles, which includes, by the way, 3,100 18-wheelers, which we need for extra business, if we were just to line them up nose to nose with no space between them, that's 243 miles of cars and trucks, and we're going to put them on our roads.
Oh, my God.
Now, that means we go from 10.3 miles per hour to basically zero. That's the scary part. Now, what's the good part? This isn't all discouraging, actually. One, because we heard yesterday in the wonderful A Better City Forum that people understand we've got a problem, we've got to deal with it. Part of it is going to be finding ways for people to live closer to work. Part of the way is going to be to get people to use more commuter rail, but then do last mile transit. So when they get off the commuter rail, they can get to work. Part of it is going to be that we're going to have many more people moving into the central cities and into our regional urban centers, not the suburbs, so they're not going to be travel as much on the highway. But if we don't plan for that now, fix the highways, because we already have 37% in poor condition, we are going to be in trouble.
But let's assume the best case scenario, Barry Bluestone, and there's this transition from getting in your car for a whole variety of reasons, not only because of the grotesque inconvenience you're projecting, but because it's good for the environment, good for the climate, good for a whole, and for your mental health, I would argue. The rail infrastructure and the bus infrastructure is not there to handle that additional load either. Isn't that part of what you're saying in this report?
That's correct. I mean, if we're going to have a 17.5% increase in our population in the inner city, the Bostons, the Cambridges, Somervilles, we're going to have to find a way of moving more people on the T. We can do that. We can't expand the stations very much, but we can run more train sets. So we can run them every, 3 minutes rather than 6 minutes. But that means,
especially since we learned last year, you don't even need a conductor. So it can really
sometimes
you can get
you don't,
a lot more
right.
trains.
Sometimes you don't even driver. They
that's what I was trying
autonomous
to say.
Trains. But the fact is that to do that, and Stephanie Pollack, our Secretary of Transportation, will tell you, we have to do a lot of technology that allows us to run trains closer to each other without getting into trouble.
So and let's complete the picture. So we have cars. We have rail, and you can touch on buses if you want in a couple of seconds. Let's go out to Logan. Mm-hmm. And that's where there's some dispute, where the head of Massport says you he believes you exaggerated the impact. And explain what the impact you project is, and then we'll talk about his sense that maybe you're off base here.
Well, we did with Logan Airport, and working with Tom Glenn and his staff, actually, was project out the growth rate that we've had over the last 5 years, and then said, if that continues, of both domestic travel and international travel, because we've got a lot more international travel given that Boston's the global city, we project a 49% increase in domestic and international passenger travel at Logan between 2010 and 2030. They've been able to handle that so far by flying bigger planes, fewer takeoffs and landings, and higher load factors. If you've been on a plane recently, you know almost every seat is filled. Mm-hmm. But the real question is, if we continue to do that, plus we have more and more air freight, just think of Amazon delivering things overnight, we're probably not going to be able to accommodate all of that at Logan. Can we do it at Manchester? Can we do it down in Providence? How can we build our air transport system so it's not so overly dependent on one airport?
You know, one of the things that comes to mind, since you're a better city, Rick Domino, is I'm embarrassed to say, I don't really know the details of this, but Marty Walsh, during the Olympic fiasco, kept saying, we've got this agenda. Was it 2030 thing anyway? Yep. And, you know, with or without the Olympics, we're going to be building for the future. The Olympics will help us get there, but even without the Olympics, et cetera. Does Agenda 2030, I think that's what it's, whatever it's called for the city, does that envision, even if it doesn't have the detail that Barry and his colleagues have provided, does that envision the increase in transportation load that you guys are describing here, or does it not?
Well, they took a different approach regarding their transportation forecast modeling, but basically it says the same thing. I mean, what we're seeing is a significant demand for transit, whether it's using our numbers that Barry so thoughtfully prepared, or one of the interesting things that transportation modeling, and you know I'm a transportation geek, mm-hmm. is what happens when we stick it in a different model than the one that Barry uses. You take the 80,000 vehicles, the model says, oh my God, these cars have no place to go. And then they start distributing them in different places. And one of the places they put trips is right on transit, because mm-hmm. the model says, okay, since they have no place to go, we're going to have to put on transit. That's exactly what they did in a recent plan that we did in the South Boston waterfront. Waterfront wants to grow by 17 million square feet. The model says, oh my God, 63% more trips want to come to the South Boston waterfront between now and 2035. 64% of those trips want to be on transit because they can't get there any other way. And the Silver Line's at 128% capacity. So, yes, the mayor has stepped back. I'm actually co-chairing an effort called Go Boston 2030. It's part of Imagine Boston 2030 and is actually very aspirational. And also very focused on how he can partner with the governor to make mass transit a better solution. But we have to really take some substantive steps between now and the next 15 years, because we have growth areas like the South Boston waterfront, Kendall Square. We have the Longwood Medical Area. I mean, in Kendall Square, we got another 8 million square feet of development, and we can't even get the red line to run on time. So we have to do a better job with increasing the capacity of our transit system, and also make some targeted expansion and find the resources and the human resource capacity to get that done.
We're talking to Rick Domino and Barry Bluestone about this report that came out about essentially the future of transportation in and around Boston.
Just a couple of little details from this Globe story about the Seaport District being overrun. There's a quote from this Julie Wormser, who runs the Boston Harbor Association, saying she's purchased Razor scooters for her staff down there so they can get around having to avoid public transportation. And then they interview this other woman who commutes to work at the Seaport via the Silver Line and talks about how people are waiting for the bus at South Station, 10 people deep, to get on the bus. It's sort of already a crisis if people are getting Razor scooters.
Yeah, the South Boston waterfront is kind of one of those classic case studies, and Barry and I have talked about it. On one hand, when I was the younger transportation commissioner many years ago, working with Fred Salvucci, when we built the Central Highway System and we put in the Seaport Access Road and we built the Silver Line from South Station to the South Boston waterfront, there was like 1,000 acres of vacant land.
Parking
there.
Lot.
Remember?
It's great.
Yeah,
you can park
right,
anywhere.
Exactly. Then from 2000 to 2013, all of a sudden there's 10 million square feet of development, you know, over 7,000 jobs, and it's the strongest economic center in Massachusetts, because infrastructure, the point that Barry's been making in his report, set the table for this growth. Now, the challenging news is that we've kind of outgrown the infrastructure that we've put there. And as I was saying, the Silver Line's at 128% capacity during the peak hours. And, you know, I'm looking at the 5-year capital plan and I'm talking to Stephanie and encouraging her, as Jim knows that I do. And I'm asking her, please buy more civil line vehicles, right? Because if we can buy more civil line vehicles, we'll get to actually the headways, as Barry was talking about.
And so, she is doing part of that, though, isn't she? Repairing some or converting some?
The good news is that her and God bless Frank DePaulo, who's a great general manager who's going to be retiring, they're buying some experimental civil mm-hmm. line vehicles because we need to find a new vehicle. So they're going to do that, but we need about 20 to 30 more vehicles as soon as possible so we can get, but that larger purchase yet still isn't in the capital plan. And of course, people like me are asking here to put it in.
So obviously Jeffrey Immelt's going to get from the Back Bay to South Boston by drone. So Barry,
yeah, probably helicopter.
That's right. One of the little space packs. You put him on this back right. And kind of fly right over there.
He's the new GE head for the three of you who don't recognize the name. One of the things the club said is you guys they're not recommendations as such. It's just identification of the problem. So we're outside the four walls of the data. Between the two of you, give us a couple common sense, big thinking recommendations, putting money aside just for the minute. We're going to get to the money issue in a minute. What are the couple of things that Baker, Pollock, et al. Could do to avoid this nightmare, which I'm sure they want to avoid at least as much as you two do?
Well, one of the things they should be doing is listening more closely to Senator Tom McGee, who's the chair of the Transportation Department. He's from Lynn, and he has been really pushing hard the idea that we should be using our water resources to get people around. You go to Seattle, people get to work by ferry. You go to Sydney, Australia, Vancouver. We have a wonderful waterfront. It's ice-free all year round now. We should be having ferry service from the North Shore down into the city, from Quincy up. We have some of that from Duxbury. We have a little bit of it. But we could add a great deal of ferry service, which requires no new tracks, no new roads. And we could get more people, particularly from the north and the south there. We could redevelop parts of Lynn. Lynn has wonderful waterfront that could be developed with housing, with hotels, taking pressure off of our housing market. So there are ways of doing this. Again, I'm encouraged by the fact that so many people stood up at the forum yesterday who are in important positions of power saying, we recognize this, we're going to start working on this much harder. That's what we have to do.
Isn't it another piece of this? Marjorie, I think, was really taken when we started reading when the Green Line nightmare was in full bloom. And now it's theoretically out of trouble, but who knows if it's going to – I mean, there's still some issues. One, Cambridge and Somerville, some people think – I mean, this House chair of the Transportation Committee, Bill Strauss, called it extortion, essentially, that was done by the administration, essentially saying 4 days before the announcement, you're either going to kick in $75 million between you or there's not going to be – a green line, but extortion or not, it worked. Marjorie's talked a lot about, shouldn't the private developers and businesses that are going to benefit start kicking in? It's a new era kind of thing. Are these financing models, are they the future or part of the future, Rick?
I think they absolutely have to be, but I think we have to be careful about how we organize them. So first of all, what discouraged me the most recently is that, and I think it's completely fine, but we went to the fares and we said, okay, we're going to increase the fares. And then the next thing we're going to do is value capture. And in theory, we're going to go right to the developers.
Value capture is what I was describing inartfully a minute ago. Yes,
exactly.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Yep.
No, that's fine.
So we're going to these two places, but we're really not stepping back. And actually, Senator McGee called for this yesterday, is what's the real statewide transportation plan and what's a comprehensive transportation finance strategy to pay for it? We can't piecemeal our way out of this transportation finance problem, and we need to really come up with a comprehensive plan and solution. So value capture is a place where maybe developers can contribute and cities can contribute. And it's because cities and towns, as we all know, really rely on real estate taxes. But the challenge is that, like, when I was the commissioner and I'd go knocking at the door of the mayor or the chief financial officer and say, by the way, can I give a piece of this real estate action to a transportation investment? You know, the budget director would say, well, Ricky, I've forecasted that money for mm-hmm. police and fire and teachers. So it's a tough conversation. And I think it really does.
Because there's so many competing demands for the same dollar.
Exactly, Jim. Yeah. So, but it's still worthwhile to put on the table. Say, for example, obviously, the South Boston waterfront real estate went up when we put all that infrastructure in place, the value of that land with it. The question is, can cities allow an increment of that new real estate tax to go towards that capital investment in the future? And I'm hoping that we'll at least consider it.
So one of my theories, I could be wrong. Did you want to say something before I gave my theory?
Well, I was going to add that, you know, we should also realize that our projection, our forecast, is based on a really healthy economy with population growth.
Right.
10.5% more people in Greater Boston, the five counties of Greater Boston, almost 28% more economic activity. Well, that augments our income tax, our sales tax, our corporation income tax. We should be setting aside some of that revenue that will be coming in over the next 15 years and making sure that a good part of it is going into the infrastructure that undergirds all that economic growth.
So wait a second. So can I read into what you just said, Barry Bluestone, that normal growth in revenue, which is what tax-phobic legislators often depend upon, is growth itself should be able to cover what needs to be done to deal with the issues you two were discussing as opposed to the infamous T-word, raising taxes? Is that where you're going?
Not completely. I'm saying that a lot of the revenue can come in through growth. I happen to be a supporter of the so-called millionaire's tax, and I think
half
there's
of which
revenue.
Is supposed to go to transportation and,
right.
And
education.
Right.
So that is one way of doing it. So that I think if we're creative enough and innovative enough, we can find the revenue and the resources to fund what we need, particularly if we think of new ways of bringing in both the private sector and the public sector.
We're talking with Rick Tamino, Chief Executive of Better City, and Barry Bluestone from Northeastern about how we're all going to be sitting in traffic and not being able to move pretty soon, whether we're going on the Red Line or in the expressway or the airport, wherever it is. Here's one of my theories about Charlie Baker, and I could be totally crazy, but because he's a Republican, he's going to be very careful. He doesn't want to raise taxes, big fiscal conservative. On the other hand, there's a lot of suspicion about the legendary waste, fraud, and corruption in Massachusetts because we have everybody hiring their brother-in-laws and endless stories about the transportation, the MBTA with the hidden pension fund and, the $300,000 mechanic, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So Baker can say he's got a handle on the finances and we have this new fiscal control board and they're looking into the money and we're not going to have any $300,000 mechanics and people, faking their sick time, all this kind of stuff. Then you could say we've kind of cut that back. Now we need to raise taxes because the MBTA is in desperate straits. I mean, I think maybe I'm wrong, but I think if people don't think they're getting totally ripped off, then they're more likely to buy into a tax increase.
When is Charlie? I'm just curious because he's been in the studio every month for about, 10 years now,
yeah.
Long before he was governor. When did Charlie Baker suggest, as soon as we have gotten all the waste and inefficiency
he
out
hasn't.
Of government, I'm going to entertain a tax
well,
increase?
Well, he hasn't, but maybe right after he's reelected for the second time, he can
no.
do but
By
I mean,
acclimation, but the way I mean, things are going.
There is
I think Marjorie is right on. We look around. Good liberals. I'm in the Socialist Republic of Cambridge. And, we see these work sites with four police officers and two construction workers. We drive all around and we see 50, 60, 70 construction sites, each of which have two people working on them.
That's right. Police details, one of my favorite subjects.
Beyond the police details, why couldn't we create a contracting method where we say, okay, we're going to fix this half mile of the turnpike now? Okay, with 80 people, and then we're going to move on and move on rather than blocking traffic everywhere. So I don't think it's just a matter of overpaid workers. I don't think that's the serious problem. I think it's a problem of contracting. I think it's a problem of trying to figure out how to do road maintenance, road construction, bridge maintenance much more efficiently. And we've got to find a way to
Okay,
do
I'm going to address Brad Bluestone and Marjorie Egan with two words, tick tock. And those are the two words. The reality is, when Charlie Baker, for whom I have colossal respect, was head of Harvard Pilgrim, which is really his calling card for governor, and I think he'd agree, even though he did a lot of work in government, he didn't say, until I have wrested every ounce of waste out of Harvard Pilgrim, I'm not going to raise premiums.
People weren't suspicious of
I'm going to raise
Harvard
premiums
Pilgrim.
And I'm going to make this more efficient, both of which he did. If he doesn't walk and chew, I want to actually before you even answer that, Rick. You both work closely with Stephanie Pollack. Wasn't she your number two over there for a while?
Stephanie was the associate director of the Dukakis Center for 9 years. We
and you're
together.
Tight with her too, aren't you?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, fine. So here she is. She was at the Conservation Law Foundation when this whole deal was struck, requiring that the Green Line be expanded. At the time, Stephanie Pollack said they can't. The government can't just say we're broke. about the Green Line thing. So I asked her on television about a week or two ago. So how does she respond? What would you say to that same woman who is you from 15 years ago? Here's what Stephanie had to say.
I wish she knew then what I know now, because there really was this notion that it wasn't going to be a T project, you know, that somehow the Commonwealth would deliver the project and that that was different from the T. And all that was really about is the source of the money, but it's still the T's job to deliver the project and then to operate it when it's done, and there's no way around that. And the T that needs to deliver that project is having a hard time delivering service every day.
And three quarters of that we would agree with, but I wish she knew what I knew now. And what I read into this, and have read into it regularly, is we can creatively manage with a guy who's an extraordinarily good manager, Charlie Baker, our way out of this mess. And the reason I'm insistent about this with you guys, it seems to me if people buy what you're selling, this report, then at some point they have to belly up to the bar and say, how are you going to pay for it, or stop fooling around? I mean, is that, Rick, yes, no?
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. And you mentioned, you said, you know, the walk and chew gum thing. You know, I think we should be able to work on two parallel tracks.
So to speak.
Yeah. We need to fix the system, deal with the issues of the credibility and the trust of our transportation agency in the T. Manju, you're absolutely right. There's a lot of perceptual challenges regarding, like, why would we give a dollar to an agency that's going to poorly spend it?
Right.
We got to get, and the Baker administration, Stephanie and the whole team's making major progress on that. Joe Aiello is joining us. He's the chair of the control board. They're doing great work on focusing on that. But, you know, the challenge is that we got this incredible amount of people that are knocking on the door and saying, let us in. We want a transit system that's going to not only work today, but we're wanting to use it tomorrow. I mean, again, the Red Line's over capacity right now. The Green Line's over capacity. The Silver Line is over capacity. The Orange Line is creeping up in that direction. We have some of our bus routes that are overcrowded and not carrying the passengers that we need to carry. So we need to make some investment in dealing with the realities of today. Plus, obviously a wonderful thing, our economy's growing. We're one of the strongest global economies in the world.
And a governor who's got more political capital than any governor in the United States of America to do whatever he wanted and have the people believe he is doing it in an efficient, economical, taxpayer-friendly kind of way. In any case, Barry.
And the last Republican that anybody likes. the fact is that we're going to get to a point where auto drivers, and I happen to drive a car a lot because I'm working in 30, 40 towns and cities around Boston, where we're going to learn that paying more gasoline tax or a vehicle miles tax is in our interest. Because if we could use that to help build a better T, a better public transit system, I'm going to be able to go faster than 10.3 miles per hour on three. And we've got to make it clearer and clearer and clearer. And I hope our report helps that unless we fix this system, including the public transit system, things will get even worse for drivers. Then maybe people will begin to realize, yes, we've got to fix it, but we also have to pay for it. And there are ways to pay for it. You know, at $2.39 a gallon, I remember paying $4.05 a gallon, adding 10, 15, 20, even 30 cents
people
a gallon to the tax, they will feel it. They will feel it, and they're starting to feel it now, just as Marjorie does when she drives here.
Great to see you both. Thanks
Thank
for your
you
work.
Very much for coming in. Rick Dimino and Barry Bluestone. Rick Dimino is the chief executive of A Better City. Barry Bluestone co-authored the State of the Built Environment Report, professor at Northeastern University, and the founding director of the Kitty and Michael Dukakis Center for Urban and Regional Policy. Again, Rick and Barry, thank you very much.
Good to see you.
Thank you. Coming up, Governor Mike Dukakis joins us to talk about the expansion of South Station. There's a community meeting tonight. Will he be there in full protest mode? Because he doesn't want it to expand. He wants something else. We'll tell us all about it next on 89.7, or he'll tell us all about it. Boston Public Radio.